This is the Breaker.News podcast for the week of December 1st, 2024. I'm Bob Mackin, publisher of the Breaker.News and host of the Breaker.News podcast. Welcome to edition number 372. The Breaker is your source for news, opinion, and analysis about British Columbia issues, institutions, and influencers. Later, I'll tell you how you can support The Breaker. On this edition, headlines from the Pacific Rim and the Pacific Northwest. I award a virtual Nanaimo bar to a difference maker. And on the Big Deal feature, my guest is North Vancouver dad Vince Verline. He's back from Peru, where he went to seek justice for his late son Camden Verline, who was electrocuted in March 2023. Learn about Camden Verline and how Vince Verline is working to hold two power companies accountable. This is the Big Deal feature on the Breaker.News podcast. Joining me is my guest, Vince Verline. He's in North Vancouver. He's on a quest for justice after his son, Camden Verline, was killed in Peru last year due to the alleged negligence of two power companies in the South American country. Introduce the audience to who Camden was. So he grew up in Roberts Creek, BC, on the Sunshine Coast. Like many 20-year-olds, he wanted to get out and see the world. And that's what he was doing, fulfilling his dreams.
Well, it's hard to convey what a kind and thoughtful and special kid he was, young man. As he was growing up, we always remarked on how thoughtful and emotionally mature and intellectually mature he was for his age. Talking about, you know, Bernie Sanders' election platform when he was 11 years old, and talking about the use of propaganda to shape people's thinking when he was about 13. And he had a really interesting connection to nature. He was very into animals and nature, but he was also a sportsman. He was top quality soccer goalie, which I had played and coached him, and he was being scouted. He was an MVP in a basketball camp. He lived in a really nice wilderness, you know, beachfront community, Roberts Creek. And so he was at one with nature and used to have friends with hummingbirds. And, you know, I could tell you stories about bees and raccoons and all these other things where he was just open to and connected with nature. But he also had a lot of friends. So he had a really strong social life. He had no ego. Like the kid, I've been trying to think of something where he didn't have, you know, kind of wonderful qualities, and it's hard to do. So it's a tremendous loss. And he had some illness during his teen years with celiac and the related anxiety and stress that comes with it. So he was in an alternative school, but he was able to finish that and graduate, and he was healthier in his last couple of years of life. And he worked at a local cafe to raise money, and he decided, I'm going to go and work in a dog shelter in coastal Peru. And it's a place that actively recruits people to come and volunteer. And so he did that for 2.5 months before he was killed. And we were talking every day. I was in Africa where I was working and living at the time. And we were talking by WhatsApp, and he was on his way to see me when the incident happened.
I mean, being in Roberts Creek, it's close to nature, close to water, but the waves there aren't quite as big as you get in Peru, and he wanted to learn how to surf.
Yes, this place is a small surfing town, Huanchaco, Peru, about 20 minutes outside of a town called Trujillo, which is, you know, think of Victoria as that's the size of Trujillo, and think of Sydney, BC as Huanchaco, and it's got a nice boardwalk and a sidewalk along about 2 kilometers of beachfront. And I had taken Camden surfing in Santa Monica and other places just when he was younger, and he liked it. And of course, Roberts Creek, where he was skimboarding, he was boogie boarding, he'd been at Tofino. Like he loved the water, he loved nature, and so it just made sense. And he worked there, and they kind of helped him find a hostel, and he was across from the beach, and he was taking surfing lessons, salsa lessons, and there's kind of a young people, both Peruvian and foreigner group there. It's not really a party town, but it is a youth hostel, surf hostel community, and the dog rescue had been going for a few years, and so they kind of got him set up, so he was really, really enjoying it. But he was about halfway through his time there and on his way to Buenos Aires and then fly to Paris and then fly with his sister to meet me in Tunisia. But all of that was lost when he was killed.
To take me back to when that happened, March 8th, 2023, when you were notified of this freak incident that he basically was walking along and electrocuted.
Yeah, I went to I got the call. It was devastating. I can't even tell you how devastating. And I was on the floor for about 3 hours and then realized that my responsibilities as the dad were major and I had to get over there and help with his repatriation and making sure the criminal and civil issues and research started right away. And I got a lawyer while I was flying and I landed and spent 4 days there, dealing with everything. What had happened was that he had finished a shift with the dogs and he had met some friends to go surfing and he walked about 100 meters from his hotel with his wetsuit and surfboard into the water and it's across a sidewalk that has a seawall and then the seawall is about a foot high and it goes down into the water. And so people meet and go into the waves. And he was with a class of people, and that day they chose that area. And he walked by an electrical truck that apparently was parked there to do work on an upgrade of the power lines that run along that waterfront. And that project had been going on for a few days. It just happened to be in front of his hotel. And there were other people around, and other kids and seniors. And there's a big Visit Juan Chaco sign where people take pictures right there. So it's extremely public. And he went surfing and he was the first out of the water and he was going back to his hotel to change and meet friends for drinks after. And they had laid out a line on the ground and no tape, no cones, no flag people, no signs, no supervisor. And somehow that line, that one black cable, was live. And we have an electrical engineer safety group that did a report. So we know what they did wrong, and we know what happened, but Camden simply walked where he had walked. And when I went down there, I took photos of how many black cables are around. Electrical lines are everywhere, dead on the street, but little like telecom cables and various. So he would have had no idea that there was anything different, could not have seen that there was any risk, and happened to step. And in fact, the electrical report people think he. The current was actually in the cement. It had transmitted through water in the cement and onto his wet feet so that he actually didn't touch it, but then he fell onto it. Sorry, it's hard to remember. So he died instantly, and people gathered and they put up electrical tape around the site to keep other people around, and I've had to see the pictures. Because I have to testify and I have to organize those files for the cases. So I spent time with the police, the local prosecutor, a very good lawyer I have from Trujillo who speaks English and is very outraged about the case, and the surfer community who are very outraged about the case. And I dealt with what I had to deal with at the morgue and at the police office and at his hotel, packing up all his stuff and getting him organized to get back to Canada. So, the worst 4 days imaginable. That's 18 months ago.
How have the officials in Peru, the Peruvian civic police and utility officials, the courts, how have they been to deal with, and how have the Canadian embassy officials been to deal with?
I've had almost no support from the Canadian embassy. They don't want to get involved, and they just said they would monitor the case over time. I don't know what that means, but they've been not very helpful. In terms of the local police and prosecutor, I think with my lawyer managing and monitoring everything, they have been at least decent in terms of managing the file and gathering evidence and opening a case. And we've built a pretty complete case against seven people, again, for the two companies, plus the two companies. And the way it works in Peru is there's a criminal process, and if you secure a criminal trial, you can use the material for that to open a civil claim. So they kind of connect, but they're separate. So I have two lawyers. And the civil sorry, the criminal trial or criminal case recently, like last week, was filed finally by the prosecutor, and the court sort of stamped the paper. It's called a disposition. It's a statement of intent to charge the seven people. And so the court's accepted that. So now I'm waiting to understand what the next step is, which I think is setting a court date for next year. But during the criminal trial, during the criminal investigation led by the prosecutor, what I've found out is that at least one of the companies has refused to participate, even though the prosecutor has the legal right to summons them and did summons them twice. So the bigger company has refused to participate, even though they were the responsible party to the municipality to replace the power line. The municipality hasn't done anything. They came to the waterfront 2 weeks ago when I was there, because I went back to push for justice and to push for the criminal case and the civil case to go forward and do the work on the civil case. And that all went well, but it's all very slow, very uphill battle, very David and Goliath. And the prosecutor took me aside and said that she's lacking the resources to actually prosecute the case. And she asked me for funding to help her office because she's underfunded and understaffed. And they don't have technical skills to assess the details of the electrical situation. And they need local Peruvian or South American technical skills. They can't accept just Canadian analysis for legal reasons. So I said yes, but I don't have the don't know how I'm going to do that, and I'm worried that the case will stall. And I'm also I don't know anything about the efficiency or corruption of the system there, so I'm dependent on those things and worried about those things.
What are the names of the companies?
Hindrandina is the Empresa Hindrandina is the bigger company. And you can imagine that they are like BC Hydro. They're a crown corporation separate from the government, but owned by the government. And then they are responsible to the municipality, but they subcontracted a second company whose name escapes me at the moment. I'm sorry. That second company has participated and testified and said in early investigations that they blamed the bigger company who were responsible to turn the power off and that their people could have been killed too. But each party's blaming the other, but one party won't even come to the table, which blows me away that a company can ignore a summons from a prosecutor. I don't know how that happens, and it makes me furious.
Now you've come back from Peru, and Camden, while he was there, was of course working at a dog shelter, and you've brought some dogs back to BC for adoption.
Yeah, when he was, since he died, I have really struggled to kind of figure things out, how you live and how you honor your kid. And one thing he talked to me about a lot before he was killed was that there were two dogs that he really loved out of the 40 or so that were there, and he sent pictures and he drew sketches, and he talked about them and how they deserved a better life. And they were called Layla and Dude, a female and a boy, both about 8. So I just decided to try to bring them up, and the shelter owners were great. Again, the people there are very outraged and also very supportive. So the people in the shelter, the people in the surfer community came together. And when I did the rally on the seawall, and they did a mass, and we had some TV coverage, and we talked to the prosecutor and everything a few weeks ago, I left Peru with the dogs, and they were scared. And it was a long, tough 32 hours, just me with two big dog kennels and my own luggage traveling through Mexico and then Toronto and then Vancouver. It was brutal, but they're here and they're doing well. And it feels like a connection to Camden to know that he loved them the most. And they're such sweet dogs, and that's great. And it feels like it's an honoring of him and his life and how he lived. So it's something.
In dealing with this case down in Peru, and also trying to get Canadian officials to show some support, what next? How is this going to unfold in the coming weeks and months?
Well, when I was down there, it was pretty brutal. To go through the process of being back on the site and reconnecting with everyone, but it was also fulfilling in the sense that there's so many people who still want to see something come out of this. And when I was prepping, to speak, I didn't really know what I was going to say. And the phrase respect, accountability, and justice for Camden just came out of my mouth. And so I want respect that they acknowledge Camden. They haven't. They haven't reached out to the family. There's no accountability. They won't stand up and take responsibility and justice, some form of follow through or punishment or settlement or guidance that says this can't happen again and his life was worth something. So those three words stand out to me, and I'm kind of compelled as his father to pursue that. So that's part of it. And then the two legal cases are, the big things to pursue. And my lawyers and I are working on that. And the role of the Canadian Embassy or any other networks, I don't know. I haven't really figured that out. And I'm doing some press coverage now to try to get more people to pull along with me on the on this. And then finally, there's been a GoFundMe created by my very close friend who has kids Camden's age, and they grew up together. And he just put that online today, yesterday, to kind of help fund the additional legal work because it's going to be another year minimum and two cases. So I'm running out of money. So I had to relocate from Africa and start my business consulting over again back in Vancouver, and it's been a hard year. So I decided I need to ask and look for some support.
And how can people give the support?
Well, there's a GoFundMe page. If you Google GoFundMe Camden Verlaine, Verlaan, you'll find it, and it has basically the text of the press release and some links to other stories. And there are stories about Camden on the CBC and the Coast Reporter from last year. So the GoFundMe is the number one. It has my contact information, or they can just Google me and send me an email. And words of support actually mean a lot. It's surprising, but Camden deserves attention and being memorialized, and I would appreciate that kind of effort too.
Well, thanks again for joining us on the Breaker.News and telling us your story and the story of Camden. Vince Verlaine from North Vancouver, who's on a quest for justice to remember his son and to save other people in the future from accidents like this, negligence of power companies down in Peru. We'll look forward to keeping an eye on this case and hopefully have you back on the podcast with some good news in the months to come as you seek the justice that you deserve down in Peru for Camden.
Thanks for your time.
Now it's time on the Breaker.News podcast for Around the Rim. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Rim. In the Taiwan news, Foxconn acquires land in Texas. Company plans to expand AI production lines to meet customer demand. Foxconn Assembly has invested $33.03 million to acquire land and facilities in Harris County, Texas. The electronics manufacturer said it purchased 478,000 square feet of land and 200,000 square feet of facilities. In Hong Kong Free Press, four Hong Kong Democrats seek to challenge conviction and sentence in landmark subversion case. The High Court on Tuesday received appeal applications from activist Owen Chow, former lawmaker Helena Wang, ex-district councillor Clarice Yung, and former union leader Winnie Yu. The appeal bids were lodged a week after the four faced sentencing alongside 41 Democrats. Their sentences ranged from 4 years and 2 months to 10 years behind bars, depending on their roles in a scheme that centered around an unofficial legislative primary election held in July 2020. In ABC News Australia, lawyers for Tiwi Island Group that tried to block gas project ordered to pay $9 million to Santos. Santos is building a 262-kilometer pipeline from its new Barossa gas field in the Timor Sea to a processing plant in Darwin. The Tiwi Islanders, led by Simon Mankara, had argued the pipeline would impact on culturally significant sites that represented the Ampji Rainbow Serpent and Crocodile Man. That's Around the Rim on this edition of the Breaker.News podcast. Now it's time on the Breaker.News podcast for Cascadia Calling. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Northwest. In Willamette Week, visit times at several Oregon emergency rooms are far longer than the national average. The two worst hospitals in the state, according to Willamette Week's analysis of 2023 data, are affiliated with OHSU. The national average for an emergency room stay at high-volume hospitals is around 3.5 hours. It's 8 hours and 47 minutes at Hillsborough Medical Center and 4 hours and 51 minutes at OHSU. In Crosscut, Amazon offers $334 million for nuclear reactors to be built at Hanford. The small modular reactor could re-establish nuclear power as an alternative energy source with the Washington-based company as its biggest investor. The tentative plan is to build a cluster of 4 small modular reactors to be owned and operated by Energy Northwest to provide 320 megawatts to the Northwest power grid. Amazon would have first access to that power for its operations, including its data centers around the Pacific Northwest. Expanding that cluster up to 12 reactors producing 960 megawatts is a future option. And in the Breaker.News, these headlines: Richmond City Councillor reveals he moonlights with a law firm. And BC taxpayers on the hook for $581 million. 2026 World Cup hosting contract revealed. Read the stories behind the headlines. Go to thebreaker.news. And introducing bobmackin.substack.com. Visit me there too. That's Cascadia calling on this edition of the Breaker.News podcast. It don't matter what color you are, 'cause love will conquer hate.
Virtual Nanaimo Bar, brought to you by Spruce Hill Contracting.
Every week we end the Breaker.News podcast on a tasty note by awarding the goodness of a virtual Nanaimo Bar to people making a difference. A virtual version of the province's favorite dessert bar goes this week to Kidsport, the charity that helps needy kids get playing organized sports. Check out kidsport.ca and consider donating to Kidsport this Christmas. And you can nominate someone for a virtual Nanaimo Bar. Send me an email to bob at thebreaker.news. That's it for the Breaker.News podcast for the week of December 1st, 2024. I'm Bob Mackin. Thanks for joining me. Did you know that on the 1st of December in 1955 in Montgomery, Alabama, seamstress Rosa Parks refused to give up her seat on the bus? It sparked a boycott of the city's buses and became a major milestone in the civil rights movement. Now you know. Send me your feedback. Send me your story ideas to bob at thebreaker.news. Bookmark thebreaker.news. You can also find us at thebreaker.ca. And introducing bobmackin.substack.com. Visit me there too. And sign up for the free email newsletter and get updates to your inbox, or follow The Breaker News as news happens on X, formerly Twitter. And you can support The Breaker for as little as $2 a month. For more information, go to patreon.com/thebreakernews. That's PATREON.com/thebreakernews. Until next week.